Welcome to The Lobbying Show, a podcast about the people in government relations, how they got into it, what their jobs entail, what works, and what doesn't. I'm your host, Jim O'Brien. Today we talk to Jeff Taylor. Jeff is a lobbyist in Washington, D.C. You can find his firm at usgri.com. Jeff comes from New Hampshire. His dad, his family, more specifically his dad, worked in radio, and Jeff went to Assumption College, and while at Assumption College, started working at a radio station near Worcester, Massachusetts, and at some point made his way over to campaign work. He gave up his radio hat and replaced it with a campaign hat. He worked on several campaigns and has been doing, has worked at several lobbying shops down in Washington, D.C. But the part that I think most of you will find interesting is the fact that he has over 50,000 followers on LinkedIn. You heard that correctly, 50,000. So we talked to Jeff about that, how that came about. It is obviously impressive, so impressive that LinkedIn asked him to come speak at a conference. And we interviewed Jeff at the stateside offices in Arlington, Virginia. We had set up a temporary studio there, and we just had a great chat. And I think you will find this interview very interesting. Jeff Taylor. You grew up in New Hampshire.
Grew up in New Hampshire.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what part of New Hampshire?
Seacoast, Portsmouth.
Okay.
Right before you go up to Maine.
Very pretty.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Actually, back then it wasn't pretty and nice. It was a military area. You had Pease Air Force Base and then Portsmouth Naval Shipyard and very little else. Now it's very knick-knack, beautiful
yes.
little port. But in the 70s and 80s, it was... Most of the kids in my class, their fathers were in the Air Force.
Was your dad in the Air Force?
My father was in broadcasting.
Oh.
And kind of the guy who everybody knew, you know, the head of the radio station in town and the people at the Air Force, and they all knew my father.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So did he did all the local broadcasting and all that?
He did. It was
I'm in trouble. You're going to see Amateur Hour, right? And you're going to be like, Jim, you're doing this all wrong. Oh, that's really neat.
When we're off air, I'll tell you some kind of fun things about it because it was a very small radio station, but it was in earshot of Boston.
Okay.
And so a lot of the young disc jockeys always wanted to get to Boston or New York, so they'd
right.
go to work for my father for a few years, knowing full well that if someone got fired in Boston, they'd listen to my father's station to see who the new talent is. And... you know, one of the better stories is Tom Bergeron, Dancing with the Stars. He started at this little Portsmouth, New Hampshire station, and then boom, 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 and now he's Mr. Dancing with the Stars, and he's a big famous person.
So. That's amazing. What station was it?
WHEB in Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Okay.
He started in Fall River, Massachusetts, and he was there for 40 years. He had a beautiful career, and it was one of those things where great American story, you know, started as an announcer, and then he started to have kids, so they let him do some sales,
mm-hmm.
and then he became sales manager and general manager. It was, he's red, white, and blue all the way up.
That's great. So. How many siblings do you have?
Just one, younger brother, still lives in New Hampshire.
Okay. So you have your brother in New Hampshire. Any other family in New Hampshire still?
My father and mother are still very active in Portsmouth. They're in their 80s, and they're just, enjoying retirement. And fortunately, they're very healthy and still very active.
Oh, that's great. Now, by active, you mean politically or just, like, playing golf and all that kind
no,
of stuff?
No, not even playing golf, but just enjoying retirement.
Okay.
Enjoying
still
the
healthy.
House and
still healthy.
And they'll watch the evening news cable shows and give me a call and tell me what is really happening in the world.
Really good. That's great. So then you went to Assumption.
That's right.
What year did you graduate from there?
84. So if your brother graduated, it's possibly we knew each other, but maybe we were in different areas.
Yeah. Did you like Assumption?
You know, I did. There was a thing on LinkedIn just yesterday about how they have a tribute to a former brother there, Brother Robert, who was a healthcare guy. And I did not like Assumption in my first year.
Okay.
In fact, I was going to leave. I had a job at a local radio station, WFTQ and WAAF,
okay,
in Worcester, and I played rugby for the Worcester Rugby. I was doing everything but college, and I was going to leave, and this 300-pound brother sat down next to me one day and introduced himself, and it turned out to be Brother Robert. He's been dead many years now, 10 years, but he slowly and surely just kept poking away, you know. This is really a good place for you. You can still stay at the radio station. And you know, and 4 years later, I graduated. And had he not sat down, there's just no way I would have stayed at Assumption.
Okay.
At that moment in time, I was not a college person. I was more of a radio.
But your first year in college, you were already working part-time at the radio station?
Yeah.
Wow.
My father let me fill in my senior year of high school, and I caught the bug. And not as a full-time person, but, you know, if someone were sick or someone, you know, it's like, you know, Jeff will spin the records for 6 hours. And I caught the bug. And so when I got down to Worcester, they didn't have a Worcester radio station. They didn't have an Assumption College radio station. So I just showed up on the front steps of the AM station, local AM station. And he said about the same thing. First of all, he knew my father. That's always a benefit. He says, you know, I started at WHEB 20 years ago. And he goes, I'll give the kid a try. You'll do the American Top 40 every morning, every weekend, which was just basically a three-album set. You put the needle on the record, and you just let it go. And an idiot can do it.
On Saturday and Sunday morning.
Saturday and Sunday morning.
As a college student, you had to get up and get yourself to the radio station, which was probably not easy.
No, but it was, I enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun. Plus, it was some money.
Yep.
And I did that. And then, you know, the program director would say, you know, Joe Blow's going to be sick. He's called in sick, so we're going to move the midnight to six guy to 7 o'clock. You come in at midnight and do the overnight. And that gives you more experience. And I did that several times. And then one or two times, the famous radio station is WAAF, the Rock and Roll Air Force. That's if you're in the AM studio, you want to be able to go into the FM studio.
Okay.
And every once in a while, someone would call in sick and say, Jeff, do you? Yes. I'll be there right away. Because that's when, you know, the girls listen to WAAF.
Right,
and the old people listen to American Top 40.
Right.
So we did that as much as possible. And I enjoyed it. But I am glad that Brother Robert
encourage you to stay.
Yeah, because it was important to get that degree. It was important.
So if you left, you don't think you would have continued with your college education?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. But, you know, I'm having a good time here talking to you. I feel my father mentioned to me one time, he said, you know, there are really good announcers, and then there are just simply good announcers.
Okay.
And you're a good announcer, Jeff. And so he had a very interesting conversation with me that, you know, look at Tom Bergeron and look at these other Duncan Dewar and all these Ted Garland, these guys who went on to become, you know, very wealthy jocks.
Yep.
And they had something that clearly I didn't have. And so I think it was probably a kind of a hard conversation for my father to tell me. I mean, well, it wasn't a long conversation, but it was like, you know, you ought to stay in college and give yourself more opportunities.
And did he articulate what the difference was between your superstars and your regular company?
No, but you could hear it. You know, I'm glad he had that. I'm glad he, you know, one of my proudest moments was when he came down to visit Worcester one morning and he sat in with me. My father sat in with me as I did my job. But you could tell. I mean, you know, there are those who have it and those who don't. And I was borderline tilting towards don't.
But you and your dad can tell. I don't think the average person can tell, but maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe not. You know, I did okay. Listen, I there's no way the program director would have put me on air if I didn't have, couldn't put five sentences together.
Right.
And so it's like, you know, Jeff's a good fill-in. You know, Jeff's good in a bind.
Yeah.
You know, if we've got a little emergency, call Jeff. He'll fill in, and we'll be no worse for wear. But, you know, we're not going to give Jeff the 7 to midnight show on AAF.
Yeah, but you're an 18-year-old kid, and you're already here in college full-time and working part-time. That's impressive. How long did you stay working in radio?
I did that for about 2 or 3 years, and then in my senior year, I kind of started to have fun at my senior year. I stopped being, I started playing more Worcester rugby football, and I started to enjoy life. I don't think I worked in my senior year. And then I got right into politics right out of college.
So your first political job, what was that? Or campaign or whatever it was.
Yeah, it was a campaign. It was, so it would have been, June of 84, and a number of races were gearing up, including back in my home state of New Hampshire, a senator, a first-term senator named Gordon Humphrey was gearing up, and he was going to run it. It was going to be a tough race because the first district congressman, a popular man, Norm DeMores, an Assumption graduate, was running on the Democratic side, and he was a popular congressman, and it was going to be a tightly watched race, and I basically, unplacable, just, Senator Humphrey, I want to work for you. Senator Humphrey, I want to work for you. Senator, until finally, I think he basically called the campaign manager, get this kid off my off my back.
And hire him. And, get him to do something.
Jim Murphy, again, a friend of mine to this day.
Jim Murphy, the current consultant down here in Washington?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
Jim was the campaign manager on that race.
Okay.
And Jim said, well, you know, the only thing we can have you do is maybe help out in the press office and take the garbage out and all that stuff. I'm your man. And that's how it happened. Senator Humphrey won a re-election. There was an opportunity. There were two opportunities offered. One was to go to D.C. and become a legislative assistant, or his driver was moving along, his driver. And so I talked to Jim Murphy. I talked to Reggie Basher, who was the press secretary at the time, and they said, well, L.A.'s are a dime a dozen in Washington, but you'll be sitting next to the senator, you know, nonstop for as long as you want that job. And it's not a sexy title, driver, but that's probably the one you ought to go, because he doesn't know his L.A.'s that well. He knows his driver very well. And so for 2 years, I was his boy in New Hampshire and drove him. And
probably had more FaceTime with him than anybody else.
That was that's what Jim and Reggie conveyed, and that's exactly what happened.
And did you learn a lot?
I learned a lot. You know, there's a news article going around right now about how Senator Feinstein's driver was a Chinese spy for 30 years. Have you seen that?
Right, right.
And, you know, when you're in the car, you're not just in the car. You're in his kitchen. I mean, you're constantly with him. And, you know, this theory that there were no Chinese secrets stolen or anything like that, I find almost remarkable, because you are literally with the man, or senator, day and night, except, you know, on weekends, or usually on weekends you're with him as well.
Right.
But, you know, the briefcase is always in the car, the folder, the action item folder is always in the car. You are constantly talking to the senator. How is it over 30 years?
And the senator's making a lot of calls.
Always.
And almost, because they get so comfortable with you, to forget that you're there.
Completely. You know, I mentioned this in an email I sent to one of my colleagues, saying, if this guy's job was to spy on, and he took nothing, and he got no secrets, then he had to be the worst spy in the world after 30 years. You know, it's not as though the senator, first of all, the senator wasn't on the Intelligence Committee, but even so, he would never confide in me secret information. But, you know, your proximity, it was a heck of a job.
Right. So you did that for 2 years, and then what? And now you're hooked. You got the political bug.
Right. I wanted to do races. I wanted to run races. I saw what Jim Murphy did for a living. I saw what the others that were involved. At the time, he wasn't very famous, but Ari Fleischer was at the Republican Party.
Okay. Washington?
He was here at the NRCC in Washington.
Okay.
And I went in to visit with him, and he said, well, there are several races that we think, you've never run a race, so there are several that are kind of not top flight because we'll put our more experienced people in there, but, you know, right. Get you a good race to start out with.
Right.
And they thought Congressman George Wortley from Syracuse, New York, was a shoo-in for re-election. So they gave me the job.
That's not a good race to get. You don't want the shoe-in.
That's right. That's right. It's never.
You do not want the shoe-in.
It's
you
never.
You want the long shot. You want that. You could never win this race.
Right. Because it makes you look good if you do. Well, George had a tough race, but George won in the end. We only won by 300 votes. And but what an experience.
Wasn't for those 300 votes, we probably wouldn't be sitting here today. You never know.
I think that's right. I think that's right.
That's great. So you did win.
We did win, and he went on to be kind of almost like a second father. He was such a beautiful man. You know, one of the first things I asked George was, could I get a selection of your news releases so that I can see what you've done in the past and all that? And his remark, he goes, well, we don't have many. I'm like, well, how many do you have? He says, not many at all. I said, why don't you do more news releases? He goes, well, because I don't think it's important. I don't think it's right to brag about something people hire you to do. And I'm thinking, this is a beautiful man.
Boy, that's old school.
That is very old school. Who would do that today? And of course, at the time, I'm like, every time you sneeze, you need to do a news release.
New
school.
You're the manager, right?
What a wonderful experience. But you're right. Those were the days where. I was single. I wasn't married. I had one of those Honda Civics, and I, you know, jammed two pairs of pants, two shirts, and a $5,000 stereo system into this car, and then a bunch of milk crates.
Priorities, right?
And so it was such a splendid.
Right.
And his daughters and son-in-laws and people like that are all still friends of mine. Friendships are everything in this. I mean, real friendships, not.
Yep.
You know, friends are a dime a dozen in this city, but the ones that actually will lay down in traffic for you, you kind of know who they are.
Yep.
And they come from your
going
youth.
Through those battles.
That's
and those,
exactly
those,
right. That's exactly right.
So did you like managing campaigns?
I did, but I was still young, and the next political season up was a presidential season. And coming from New Hampshire, every 4 years, you're kind of important.
You are ground zero.
And you know, the other years, you're not as important.
And here you had been driving a very popular senator for 2 years.
All over
New
Hampshire.
Knew the state like the back of your hand.
Yeah.
Your family's from there. Your dad works at a radio station.
Yep.
I mean,
Everything checked off the box. And so, yeah.
And now you have campaign experience.
That's right. All of the above. And then because you do that, because you're young and they kind of know who you are, and there are a fleet of Jeff Taylors,
yes.
You know, all
yeah.
over the country, and all of the candidates start to line you up. So Andy Card, White House Chief of Staff, he wasn't at that point in '88. He was a guy who was living on a cot in a house in Concord.
Right.
But he called me and said, you know, come and visit. I'm doing the vice president's race, Bush for president.
Mm-hmm.
But then like 13 minutes later, whoever the head of the Pete DuPont campaign called and the Bob Dole campaign and the Jack camp came, they're like, and they're calling everybody. They're not just calling me, but they're calling everybody. They want to get all the young meat in the office that are going to also sleep on a floor for their candidate. And, you know, after that point, then all of the principals start to call. You get the call from Kemp, you get the call from Dole, you get the call. And I must
really?
Say, oh, yeah, oh well,
Trying to lobby you to join their campaign.
Yeah, because New Hampshire and Iowa, I think, are cut a separate. You know, the principals actually do get on the phone with even the minor staffers.
Because it's so critically important.
Yeah.
It's just, okay.
I doubt they did that for the Colorado field director.
Right, or Connecticut. Right.
So... I think, but when you get a call from the Vice President of the United States, it kind of tips the scale, and that's when, you know, I talked to my mother and father. I'm like, how do you not go with Bush? And so that was that.
So you worked on the Bush campaign in New Hampshire.
I did.
Wow.
And there were like five Jeff Taylors as I walked in the front door. I'm like, okay,
that's all right.
I'm not going to be making any calls here. They're all like me.
Right.
So it was
And how was that experience?
Wonderful. And that's another one where, you know, we all stay in touch. I sent a note just recently to Andy, and I was up in Boston for a biotech event probably 2 months ago, and saw two of my Bush 88 friends. And a lot of the Bush 88 friends came down to D.C., so a lot of them are still here. We all have kids about the same age, so mm-hmm. we see each other all the time. And
mm-hmm. Was Ron Kaufman part of that campaign?
Well, he was our supreme boss at the time.
Okay.
So Ron reported to Lee Atwater.
Okay.
Andy reported to Ron.
Okay.
And a very little known fact, but back in those days, Ron and Andy were brother-in-laws.
Right.
We saw a lot of Ron. Okay. And then you had the junior field. That's where we were.
Yeah.
In the basement.
What's Andy doing today?
Well, I think he's retired, but he was the president for a good long time of Franklin Pierce College up in New Hampshire.
Okay.
And I see him on Facebook and water skiing, and I think he's kind of retired up
okay.
in New Hampshire. And he and his wife have a nice – she's a pastor
okay.
of a church up there. So.
Okay.
But it's good to see where everybody is. And
kind of ends up.
Yeah.
So is it after that campaign you came to D.C.?
Yeah, I had been in D.C. a little bit. Gordon Humphrey sent me to D.C. For about a year
okay.
before Ari and I met at NRCC. After that, he became president,
right.
And I went into the administration for
okay.
a very brief amount of time.
Okay.
Government work was just not my cup of tea, and
okay.
in fact, Lee Atwater was making all the calls that said, "You've had your cushy job for 8 months. Now I've got a race for you in Texas." Well, I'm not so sure. I don't think I asked you the question. You're going to Texas. Okay.
Is that where you went?
Yeah, I went down and did Attorney General's race in Texas, and Clayton Williams was running, so I did some work with his campaign. And,
okay.
You know, it was kind of and actually, that was a bit of a demarcation line. The question is, Texas is a wonderful place to live and grow up and have a family and play politics, certainly, And the question was, do I stay here for the rest of my life, or do I go back to Washington? And I made the decision, because I had been dating. I need to back up just a pinch here. I worked with George Bush's primary campaign, but I did not work for Bush Quayle.
Okay.
Another candidate called me. Jim Dozier from Florida was running in the Naples, Florida seat. And so I wanted to run a race. I didn't, after New Hampshire, again, not to disparage the Colorado field team, but I didn't want to go to Colorado. I wanted to go manage a race. So I went and managed that race, and that's where I met my wife.
Okay.
So.
On the campaign?
On that campaign, actually on a different campaign, the guy slaughtered us in the primary. So I went on the guy who beat us in the primary was Porter Goss, who then served in Congress for 20 years, became a very good friend of mine and my wife's, and became a CIA director. And
yep.
He said he's a wonderful man, but I met my wife on that race, then the president, vice president, won the presidency in that election, and I went into the administration for a brief time.
Okay. The name of your firm is?
USGRI.
GRI, okay.
.com.
When was that formed?
After the 96 race, my wife and I wanted to really be married. And so running around the country running races was just getting... So I worked on Steve Forbes' presidential race in 96.
So actually, let's go through them quick. So after the after the Bush, you went down to Florida, ran that campain. Then you came, you, little time
into the administration. Went to Texas.
Yep.
And then right around the time of Texas, I actually, for a brief period of time, ran a think tank with Senator Malcolm Wallop.
Okay.
But I needed to get back to Capitol Hill because the end goal was to get into government relations, to actually start making money, to become a professional.
Yep.
And to do that, I needed to get – I had worked on Capitol Hill, but at a very, very low legislative assistant driver level. So one of the real stars of the party back then was a guy named David McIntosh, who now runs the Club for Growth, but he was the representative on the Newt Gingrich Revolution, the freshman class.
Right.
And he needed a a chief of staff, and he was looking for a Hoosier. I'm not a Hoosier. And so I didn't apply. But about a year later, his chief of staff wanted to go back to Indiana, and that was my opportunity. And so I spent the rest of the 1990s on Capitol Hill as David's chief of staff. And David and I are very good friends, and he's certainly a big wheel, certainly now in the Republican Party. He ran for governor and lost in Indiana. But at that moment, that's the year George W. Bush had won. George W. Bush had spent a lot of time with his father in New Hampshire in 88, so we all knew each other. And okay. He becomes president, and then that's the big deal. Do you go into the administration of George W. Bush, which I did not like my government service in the 88,
right?
Or do you finally go...
Find your career.
Yeah, and I did. And I joined a law firm, an Indiana law firm named Barnes and Thornburg.
Okay.
And spent 2 years there building the government relations practice. It was not a... actually, 7 years. I spent 7 years there. And... not a very political firm, good firm, but not a very political firm, and I did want to do some more politics, so I went to work for Mercury Public Affairs,
okay.
A big New York outfit.
Yep.
And at that point, one of my Democratic friends was looking to kind of branch out on his own, and I was ready to branch out, and that's when USGRI took place. Paul Sweet, who was Pelosi and Waxman proteges and all that stuff. And my conservative credentials were kind of bulletproof after working with David on the Hill.
I would say Club for Growth is bulletproof conservative credentials. I don't think anyone will question that.
Well, when they do, I kind of giggle at people saying, I don't think you know who I am. Paul Sweet's a guy probably when working on Capitol Hill, Paul Sweet's a guy I probably wouldn't have crossed the street to spit on. But now he and I are partners.
What year did you form that?
2010.
Okay. And then was it, your first job on Capitol Hill was as chief of staff. Is that unusual?
The first real job, yeah. I mean, I did go.
You did a few of those things,
yeah.
But.
But yes, that's a very interesting question. It's not unusual if you've actually run a race, and I was not involved in David's race.
Well, that's the part that I found. It's not like you ran his race,
yeah,
and he said, "Come to Washington." You had run other races.
So. Yeah, I'd run. He clearly wanted to run for governor down the road, so he clearly wanted a chief of staff who had some semblance of, you know, what it takes to put together pieces to run a race.
Okay.
A lot of freshman members bring their campaign managers with them to be the chief of staff.
Yes.
And I've always thought that that's an okay thing. You've worked hard, you get the prize, and the prize is chief of staff. It's ironic to see that once a member of Congress has been in office for 6 or 8 months, a lot of the chief of staffs get thrown overboard because they figure out this is a good guy who runs a race, but he's not a good chief of staff.
Right. Very different skill set.
That's exactly right. And I think the guy who told me that, you know, David was looking for a Hoosier, he was the guy who was got the chief of staff job, but he's also the guy who came to me about a year and a half, 2 years later, saying, "Jeff, this whole Hoosier thing is, he's when I go back to Indiana, he's going to map it out." Now, here's the other thing that I remind David every once in a while, but in that initial interview with David, his wife was in the room, and his wife asked me a lot of questions, and that's the thing that you get nervous about. All right, who am I working for here? Am I working for the congressman or the spouse? And in fact, I asked David that right afterwards, and David said, "You'll probably never see Ruthie again." Now, I've seen Ruthie a lot, and Ruthie would bop in every once in a while, but Ruthie was protecting her husband. And after that, I really didn't see Ruthie all that much, except on social occasions. And so now whenever I see Ruthie, I tend to gravitate to her more than I gravitate to David, because I like Ruthie.
Yeah.
Not that I don't like David, but I do like Ruthie. She turned out to be a tremendous asset to the congressman and to her husband.
And how long were you chief of staff?
I think it was 6 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was very enjoyable because the congressman was very good. David was a very good member of Congress.
And you guys had a good relationship.
Very good.
He sounds like he was a good boss.
He was, and he was very. David is a conservative. David has a center. He knows what's right and wrong, but David also is persuadable. You know, he built a very good team, not just me, but we had a very good team. And he would bring in, the legislative director, the legislative assistant, and say, "I'm about to vote this way. Are you okay with that?" And if the LA said, "Oh, I'd vote the other way," well, first of all, the staff would have to have his ducks in a row.
His facts
right.
Reasoning why.
But David was, David was open and saying, "All right, you've persuaded me." And usually the staffer would say, "David, you appreciate Congressman Sam Johnson's opinion, and I know he's going to vote this way. On your way down to the floor, you might want to touch base with Sam and see why are you on this side." And those are the kind of things. So he was a very good member. He was on the leadership team, the extended leadership team, mm-hmm. As the head of that freshman class. And do you remember that there was a group of Republicans that tried to remove Newt Gingrich from Speaker?
Yes.
The coup, they called it, the coup. And it was a big group. And it blew up in their face. But that was the forerunner to what was called the Republican Study Committee. And the Republican Study Committee were John Doolittle, Sam Johnson, Dan Burton, and Ernie Istook, and three or four others. But they didn't want to be the face of the Republican Study Committee. By the way, back then it was called CATS, the Conservative Action Team. It evolved into the Republican Study Committee, the conservatives.
Right.
And they went and asked David to be kind of the first chairman of the group, and David was. And for 6 years, he was the chairman of that group. And you would classically call it the Freedom Caucus of today. But back then, we didn't try to overturn huge pieces of legislation. We would kill a rule, or we would get enough votes to stall a measure, and then Gingrich and DeLay and Army would have to come to David and the others and say, "What do you want? Well, we want this paragraph put in so that you don't spend an extra $30 billion on something absurd." And that paragraph would get put in, and the bill would pass the next day. So in other words, that crew back in the 90s knew how to do things to, and frankly, I think today's Freedom Caucus is starting to figure out how to do that, leverage their power in surgical ways.
To get something.
Instead of saying, "We're going to shut down the government," or "We're going right. to attach Obamacare to the tax bill," or something. They now know how to say, "All right, we're going to incrementally get this thing done, and at the end of the day, we'll be where we want to be."
Because you're actually making legislative changes.
Exactly.
Laws,
and
right.
I'm glad to see the Freedom Caucus kind of evolve into a do-something organization.
Yeah, yeah. And so tell us about your firm. Is there an area that you focus on? We have people that listen to the podcast that are state lobbyists and federal, so we have some people that don't do a lot of work on the Hill. So tell us about, maybe the area you do or things that you've worked on.
Well, we're a very small firm. There's, four or five revolving people in the firm, Democrats and Republicans, and, we're the quintessential small firm. One of the things that when Paul and I left was we left right around the time of the recession, and there were very few $25,000 a month clients out there at that moment. And so, the key was, a $10,000 a month client doesn't look half bad. And so we can do that, whereas firms can't.
Right, because if you have a lot less overhead.
Exactly.
Okay. Did you think about going to a big firm? Or back then, there probably was not many jobs to be had.
That's right.
Okay.
A lot of them were cutting their overhead. The other thing is, I had a pretty good book of business, but it's, if you go to a bigger firm, they want an even bigger book of business. So it's like, all right, I'll keep all of my book of business, and I will go out and try to find, clients that need government relations, but that certainly can't some of them can't even come up to 10 grand a month or anything. So, you know, a small biotech that's going into their third phase, FDA third phase trial, you know, they probably could do 5 grand a month. Okay, can I make that work? Can I put together a scope of business, Paul and I, that provides them with a good amount of business, and then we are able to take their five, because we have another client out there that just came on board for 10,000 a month. That's everything's balancing out. We're all making a profit. We're all, you know, providing a service for our clients. And sure enough, one by one by one, we were able to, you know, build a nice little firm where we weren't providing $25,000 a month's worth of work for $5,000, so we were able to meet that happy medium. And, you know, I know you reached out to me on LinkedIn. I think at one time, I think our entire book of business came through LinkedIn.
Well, I...
7 of our clients, I think.
Really?
Yes.
Well, how... Well, let's put LinkedIn on the back burner for a second, because that's a whole separate discussion. So if you're working with a biotech client, I assume you're trying to is there legislation you're trying to get passed, or is there working with agencies? Or
working with the biotechs, it's mostly with the agencies. So okay. You know, getting some of these smaller companies into the NIH, National Institutes of Health, or National Cancer Institute, so that. You know, there are so many of these cancer companies out there, infectious diseases, and the NIH doesn't even know they exist. If they stumble across them at a convention or an industry. So what we try to do is we just had a recent brain cancer company, small, in California. NIH doesn't know who they are, really. But they use a lot of data from the old days of NIH. And so when we presented that to the new doctors at the NIH, they're like, oh, when we were in our 20s, we were involved in that research. Someone's actually using it. Yes, come on in. I'll pull together 17 doctors in NIH to spend 2 hours with you. That's worth its weight in gold, because then you start to really work. You know, if that information worked well for you, are you aware that this took place in 1982? No, I didn't. Well, we're going to staple that to your stuff. And
your client must have been thrilled.
Well, sure. And then they're like, you know, there are other avenues for funding as well. Mm-hmm. Now, you know that, you know, you're a glioblastoma, which is what John McCain passed away from. Brain cancer, but are you aware that there's other funding over here that also has a dovetail with brain cancer, but it's not quite brain cancer. It's kind of in the ovarian cancer area, but it can still be applied with the science you're using. You come out of those meetings with so much information as to follow up. Very rarely do we run into an area where a biotech client, where you need to have some legislation or report language pursued. And if you do, you kind of check it out with your industry organization first to make sure you're not getting cross with them.
Right. So on those things, you're spending much more time at the agencies and not on the Hill. Are you spending... do you have to spend a lot of time on the Hill, or do you find you can do most of it by email and phone? And
It depends on the client. We have a client, the one that was in town in 100 degree weather last week. It's the roofing industry, and they do an enormous amount of work with the General Services Administration and procurement issues and stuff like that. You know, you'll go to the GSA and say, we're aware of this problem, but we can't simply snap our finger and get it done. You have to go to Capitol Hill, and then your entire focus shifts to Capitol Hill and the Appropriations Committee, and maybe getting some report language to help the GSA along. And then it's like an orchestra. You know, you don't want to annoy GSA because your livelihood's tethered to them, but, you know, maybe there are some things that we can help as you're
proceeding. Capitol Hill.
Yeah.
So you had mentioned LinkedIn. Last I looked, looked at LinkedIn, you had 50,000 plus followers.
I think. Well, that's on a group. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's incredible.
Well. But that's not one of the big ones. So there are some that are in the 200,000 and 300,000 followers.
Government relations?
No. I think we're the bigger one and biggest one, or one of the bigger ones in the government relations space. But there are others that are.
So you have the U.S. and international.
Right. What happened was, early on when government when LinkedIn started, a friend of mine said you. I had just started at Barnes & Thornburg. It's very hard to pick up clients. It's very hard. It's a very hard talent to get new clients.
Do you think that's the hardest part of the business?
I do.
Yeah.
And you know, you're always looking for that next client. What happens all of a sudden? You lose one client. Then you're down two. And so, yeah, you're constantly.
We have yet to have anybody tell us that that's not the number one issue.
It's when you're not servicing a client, you are trying to find a new client. You're trying to get to that next rung.
So the LinkedIn, the friend said, get on LinkedIn.
I said, well, that just seems like a damn hokey thing. And he said, well, think about it, and because I just don't think it is. And he was very prescient. The more I got involved, the more I got involved with it, the more it started to make sense. Whereas Facebook never made sense to me. Twitter has never made sense to me. But LinkedIn, at some point it clicked. At some point, someone called from off of LinkedIn and said, do you do intellectual property? And I said, well, I don't, but I believe we have a practice group inside the firm. This was a law firm. Well, it has to be ceramic IP. Ceramic? And I said, all right. I picked up the phone and I told one of my colleagues, I said, but it has to be ceramic. And the guy on the other end said, that's me. I do ceramic IP. I said, well, don't blow a billable hour on this, but why don't you just chat and see if there's any business there? And about an hour later, he came up and he says, we got about $1 million book of business.
Wow.
He's shifting it all over from this firm to our firm.
Because of LinkedIn.
Yeah. And that's when I went skyrocket. I'm like, holy moly, this is outstanding.
So how did you go from zero followers to 50 plus thousand?
Well, two things. First of all, that 50,000 is in the group.
Okay.
So I'm only at about 30,000 in direct connect. And actually,
do you know how funny that sounds? Yeah. I mean, do you know how many 30,000 is? Yeah. All right. I love how you are making sure that you are absolutely correct. So go ahead, explain the difference.
Well, the funny thing is, people come call me all the time and say, I see Joe Blow is connected to you.
Oh.
I'm like, I don't know the guy. He's one of 30,000. But
so you have 30,000 connections on LinkedIn.
30,000 first degree connections. And many years ago, not to bore you here, but the...
It's not boring at all. People are going to care about this.
Well, the LinkedIn was originally designed so that if I knew you and I wanted to know you, then I would link in with you.
Yep.
I wouldn't link in with 30,000 people. I just linked in with my friends and my colleagues, and that would form a very tight-knit group, because then you would... By being linked to him, you're vouching for him.
Right.
Well, that just kind of blew out the door the first 4 or 5 years of LinkedIn when people started going for 30, 40,000, 50,000. At some point, they put a limit at 30,000.
Okay.
So I'm like at 29,000, and I'm keeping below 30,000 just so that when a CEO wants to connect with me, he's not blocked from doing it. So I'm keeping that 100 or 200. I'm saying no to a lot of people now.
Okay, to keep it low. 30.
Yeah. Now, how do you get to 30,000? What happens is when you get to a certain number, and I think the number's probably 5,000, 6,000, all of a sudden you start showing up on people's wall or thing. They start to invite you. So I'll wake up every morning and there'll be about 100 requests to...
Wow.
Because they want access to my seconds and thirds.
Got it.
They really don't care about me, and that's the theory here. It's like, all right, someone has just asked me if I want to be a direct connect. Well, they're a graphic designer in Denmark. I don't think that's going to get me a lobbying client out of that, but maybe out of their two seconds and thirds, when they populate the search engine, all of a sudden there's some value in that.
Yeah.
I still don't think so, but you never know.
Right.
And so the search engine's everything. You know, I've got 500 connections. Well, that's good, but can you, it exponentially grows at 1,000, 2,000, 5,000. It all goes into your search engine. So you don't care about Jim. You care about who Jim's connected to, because they all get dumped into your search engine. So if I say Connecticut CEOs, if I only have 500 connections, only 10 people show up.
Right.
If I have 30,000, 200 show up in my search engine. So search engine's everything.
Search engine on LinkedIn.
Yes.
Okay. Search engine is everything.
That's
interesting.
What I think.
Okay.
And then at that point, then you can do one of two things. First of all, you can get a small subscription, and mine is small. It's $50 a month, but it gives you like 10 abilities to go directly to these. Once you pull these, cybersecurity CEO Connecticut. Okay, I'm going to send a direct note to each of them.
Yep. This is the premium you're talking about, whatever.
Yeah, the premium package.
Yep.
In the early days of LinkedIn, I was such a cowboy that LinkedIn called one day and said, you know, we don't have any money, but could we bring you up to New York City and could you speak to a whole bunch of PR firms about the benefits of LinkedIn? And I'm like, oh, sure, I can do that. I mean, there's, you know, can I send you a small bill? And they said, well, we really don't have any money at all, but we could give you a free full subscription to LinkedIn. God, I abused that privilege.
How many years did you have that?
Only one, but I think I sent a direct note to 300 million people. Every night I'm on there. Like, before this runs out, I need to make sure that I touch base with everybody. But the other big thing is that they allowed you to start groups.
Okay.
And groups. The what was it called, the old thing, the League of Lobbyists here?
Yeah.
I got my nose under the hemp tent before they did. Every once in a while, I'll get a guy who belonged to the League of Lobbyists saying, man, you went through LinkedIn like a hot knife through butter before we ever got our act together there. And that is a way to really get people. That's where the 50,000 are in the U.S. government relations and public affairs group, but at some point a lot of international people started joining it too. So I started the international one.
Okay.
Because they're more, they call themselves public affairs people, not government relations. They don't call themselves lobbyists, and I kind of wanted to try to keep them separate.
Okay.
Now the international one is much larger than the U.S. one.
Okay.
It's something like 60 or 70,000 in the international one. So you can send a message to them once a week on something that's going on. I just sent them an article about CBS News had an article about what's facing Congress for the next 3 months. You know, prior to the things, you know, the spending bills and Kavanaugh.
So to these groups, you can send a message once a week.
Once a
week. And on the national, you have 50,000 plus followers.
Yep.
Wow, it's just incredible. So
Once
a week you can communicate with 50,000 people, assuming they're looking at it.
Yeah, you don't know how many people actually click on it.
Right.
But I don't know, 5%.
So do you have any tips or advice for people who are creating LinkedIn groups? Might be out there in Colorado, want to create a Colorado state lobbying group as to how to increase their followers or.
Well, it's a great way to increase your followers because the minute they ask to join your group, two things happen. First of all, a default message goes out to the person saying, thank you for asking to join our group. We'll review it in 24 hours and let you know. And
right.
I just click the whole thing and they all get accepted. But when they all get accepted...
And here I thought we went through a vigorous background check. God,
not at all. So I'm going to tell you something that's it's kind of fun that I get a call about 4 years ago. Some mass murderer is on the loose, and I'm connected to him on LinkedIn. Yeah, LinkedIn. This guy's heavy duty on LinkedIn, and he's been picked up by like the San Francisco police. And one of the guys says, hey, Jeff, Yeah, the guy on CBS News tonight.
He's in our group.
You're a first degree connection to him.
Oh, my God.
So everybody's on LinkedIn. Everybody's on. And all the CEOs are on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, when I see, we picked up a client a year ago, and they had just done their IPO, and I just sent a little note, and they said, well, yesterday we didn't need a government relations team, today we do. And it really comes down to that. One of the funny stories Paul and I tell is that we did set out to be a lobbying shop for smaller companies. Mm-hmm. You know, we will continue consider the $5, $75, $10, $12,000 a month things, while the Googles hire the big boys. Mm-hmm. And some guy calls me off of LinkedIn. He's the head of Schneider Electric, the 300th largest company in the world, and he says, "Our board just talked about this, and you know, would you be willing to at least put a plan together? We'll pay you for the plan, and then we'll decide whether we want to implement the plan and who to implement." And you know, we went through, and they paid us, and we did a very nice job. First project, I mean, for one of the largest companies in the world. At the end of the day, the guy calls us back and he goes, "We're hiring you guys to implement the plan." And Paul's like, "Really?" believe it.
That's great.
So, you know, our first client out of the gate was a massive client. So, and they stayed with us for 7 years. We did a good job for them. And we did not have a marketing budget. LinkedIn was it. We went whole hog.
It's worked out. I mean, getting back to...
when competitors would ask us, "Jeff, are you on LinkedIn?" We'd say, "No, we're not on LinkedIn. You should be on Twitter. Get on Twitter." We didn't want them to get involved.
And what's the best way to increase followers for these people starting these local groups?
Yeah, good. Find the niche. The two things I would do is be more conscious of who you say yes to.
Okay.
When I started it, I was all about volume. I want to get to 50,000. If I had my druthers now, I'd be like, I'd rather have 2,500 pure government relations, pure public policy. It's too late now for me. But if you had a group that, you know, like a biotech government relations group or an insurance in Connecticut or something, that is just, you know, the hardcore 500 people that I would do that. The other thing is, when you click on it and say yes, there is an ability for a message. The minute you click it, on a message to go to the new group member saying, "Hey, thanks for being a part of my group. Why don't you directly connect with me so that we can have more of a networking and dialogue?" And you know, 9 times out of 10 is like, "Well, absolutely," and they just click, and you become a first degree on top of that. So there's. That seems like you're gaming the system, and it kind of is. On the other hand, the whole thing is a networking. You know, how does the group, your corporate page, they're allowing you to do more things with your corporate page, make it look nicer, almost kind of competing with Facebook. You know, with Facebook's corporate pages, you can put bells and whistles. For a long time, the LinkedIn one was a tombstone. But now you can put some pictures up there, you can do some interactive stuff. And so that's your corporate page. So now you have groups, corporate, and it's kind of like an all-in-one.
Okay.
And now that it's owned by Microsoft, I think you're going to start to get more real high-tech stuff, social media stuff involved.
Yep. Jeff, we really appreciate you coming in. This has been just fascinating.
Glad we could pull it off.
Yeah. So thank you.
Sure.
Well, there it is. Not very often you hear someone who worked with Lee Atwater, Ron Kaufman, and Andy Card. So very interesting. We appreciate Jeff taking the time to sit down with us. Hope you enjoyed the interview. Don't forget to check us out on Twitter at The Lobbying Show and Facebook. And if you haven't already, subscribe and make comments about the show. We'd love to hear from you. Have a great week. See you next Monday.